From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Conflict has erupted on the streets as the Olympics take place in Brazil between supporters of the interim president, Michel Temer, and supporters of the suspended president, Dilma Rousseff, who faces an impeachment process on charges of violating budget laws. The battle on the streets takes place as Temer has been struggling to govern the country in the face of dismal, record-low approval ratings. RT's Ilya Petrenko filed this report from Rio de Janeiro.
Many would think that most of this wind is blowing from outside Brazil, but the Olympic Games are happening here while the country's democratically elected president Dilma Rousseff is under a lengthy impeachment process. A lot of Brazilians believe that it is a coup and want to try and use the Olympics as a chance to deliver their message to the world. Friday's opening ceremony was marred by violent protests.
Once the competitions kicked off, locals brought the protest inside the Olympic arenas.
They may have like a very low percentage of approbation in the population. They buy their tickets. They have the right to watch the game. They are Brazilian. They have the right by the constitution to speak what they want, but they want to silence us. If the person resists to go out, he's gonna be maybe arrested if they keep resisting or putting out by force of the stadium.
One Olympic volunteer and anti-Temer activist got so mad with Brazilians getting kicked out of the venues, he gave up his volunteering and boycotted the Olympics.
On the first day of the games, I was due to serve as a volunteer at a tennis match. Before it started, I saw a video on YouTube showing people with anti-Temer posters being driven away from the stadium. This was a very bad thing to do. Most citizens support the protesters, who are not causing any trouble. Temer's regime is illegal. No one actually voted for him. He and corrupt officials masterminded the coup. I think the protests are legitimate, so I decided to stop being a volunteer.
Lewis's fellow activist Tayane says you can't expect big street rallies during the games when the army is policing every corner, but the anti-government movement is looking for any opportunity to make its voice heard.
Our media is biased, and they go with the higher classes that, of course, don't like Dilma because her government is for poor people.
So perhaps the status quo will hold until the end of the Olympics. But then, expect an all-out battle for power in Brazil. Ilya Petrenko, Rio de Janeiro.
On Monday, Republican candidate Donald Trump presented a portion of his economic program in Detroit. CCTV's Jessica Stone has more.
In Monday's economic policy speech, Trump proposed steep tax cuts.
My plan will reduce the current number of brackets from 7 to 3, and dramatically streamline the process.
But he's also proposed equally steep increases in government spending, policies that could drive up U.S. debt and disrupt the global economy. Progressive think tanks say Trump's previous tax plan would have cost the U.S. economy around $1 trillion a year for 10 years. Enough people have noticed to boost Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton in the polls. She has whittled Trump's lead on handling the U.S. economy. According to an NBC Wall Street Journal poll, Trump now leads Clinton by just 4 points, down from 11 in May. Trump is using free trade deals as weapons to attack Clinton.
A vote for Hillary Clinton is a vote for TPP, and it's also a vote for NAFTA.
He also promised to invest in U.S. infrastructure and bring back manufacturing jobs, he says, went overseas to countries like China. Clinton criticized Trump's proposals, saying they rehash trickle-down economics, a failed economic policy from the 1980s.
She's also planning to make her own economic speech in Detroit on Thursday. Jessica Stone, CCTV, Washington.
The economic plans of both Trump and Clinton were the subject of our discussion with Dr. Richard Wolff, Professor Emeritus of Economics, via Skype, Tuesday. Dr. Wolf, pleasure. Thank you for coming back. We appreciate it.
My pleasure too, Don.
So Trump laid out his a sketch of an economic plan, some standard Republican fare in there, supply side, et cetera, on the one hand, or trickle down, rather, on the one hand. On the other hand, some interesting things that are not part of the usual Republican fare or the bipartisan consensus, particularly with trade and issues like that. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think it was interesting that he chose in the city of Detroit to open his speech by a correct, by the way, depiction of the catastrophe that Detroit is. Granted, not in the hotels in the middle of town that have been spruced up over the last few years in order to sustain the illusion that Detroit is quote-unquote coming back, which if ever there was hyperbole, there it is. Just to remind everyone, although he didn't do it as well as he should have, the population of Detroit in 1970, when it was the center of the American automobile industry, was just shy of 2 million people. The population of Detroit today is about 700,000 people. So you're talking about a city that has thrown away a major majority, large majority of its citizens, leaving behind thousands of abandoned homes, empty schools, boarded up stores. The minute you go literally four blocks from the downtown hotel and condo glitz neighborhood where the conventions occur, you will see what modern capitalism can do in the way of community devastation. He should have really made much more of it, but at least give him credit. He did say that this is what it is he wants to reverse, to deal with, to overcome, to change. You don't even get that from most politicians, not even in Detroit, let alone Michigan, let alone nationally. But then, as you point out, the sad thing is, beginning with a good premise, beginning with a more honest assessment of what the reality on the ground is than the incumbents dare to ever say, he then goes on into the realm of, I don't know how to say this politely, junk.
Right.
Old Republican junk. You're going to cut taxes. Let me remind everyone, just put on my economics hat as a professor. Back in the 1950s and 60s, we had much higher taxes on business and much higher taxes on wealthy people than we have today. And we had much more rapid economic growth. We had much lower unemployment over the long space of those two decades than we have today. But what happened between then and now was that we went on a tear, operated by both Republicans and Democrats, to lower taxes on businesses because they are job creators, only to find ourselves at the end of this process, when we have reduced taxes on corporations and the rich to small fractions of what they once were, we're now stuck with an economy that collapsed in 2008, that has long-term unemployment. The current number is a delusion because it doesn't count the 5 million people who have left the labor force since 2008. We have an economy full of Detroits and Clevelands and Philadelphias, my hometown, Youngstown, Ohio, and many more like it. It is a unmitigated failure to argue that cutting taxes even more is going to come with a different outcome from what it has shown us over the last nearly half a century. So, yeah, it is amazing that this stuff can be trotted out. When he said that he wants to get rid of the inheritance tax altogether, listening to this from a billionaire who's running against a millionaire, Mrs. Clinton, this is surrealistic that the American people listen to this or watch it and do not get the impulse to throw a glass at the TV screen is the only mystery that's left. It's a tired old claim. When he says he's going to renegotiate trade deals and make them work better for us, I mean, sure, that sounds real nice, but what does it mean? We've been negotiating trade deals. By the way, both Republicans and Democrats have been doing that, and over the last 40 years, and that hasn't improved the economic well-being of the mass of our people. NAFTA didn't do that when Bill Clinton passed it. The TPP, you know, it's all the same. The problem is we have an economic system that works for a tiny number of people at the top, the 1% who really cash in, maybe the 10% who work for them, who do pretty well, and then the rest of the people are just being left to forage for themselves in a situation of less job security, less benefits that go with the job, less public services. That's the reality, and the rest of it is make-believe.
You know, conceding the point, I completely agree that the problem is systemic in all we're talking about in these campaigns, to the extent there's any discussion of policy, is trying to tweak a broken system. One of the things that caught my attention was the fact that he brought up this, it sounded like, because I'm not familiar with what the tax rates are or what other penalties there are to repatriate this capital that's abroad. But he was talking about, it sounded like some sort of tax break for people to do it to induce a return of this capital that is abroad and to input that into the economy. How plausible is that? And what are we talking about maybe in terms of scale?
Well, the scale is impressive. There's something, depending on how you count, but we're talking in the trillions, 1 or 2 trillion, maybe even more, of profits earned by American corporations and kept by them overseas. Now, there's a game going on here, and it's a simple game. If you keep your profits overseas, if you claim that they were earned overseas and are being kept overseas, then you are not taxed on them. That is, the way the American tax code works, you are required to pay taxes if and when you bring them home back here to the United States. So let's start with that. First of all, that's a scam. And let me explain. If an American company based, let's say, in Cincinnati, Ohio, has business abroad, let's say in France, what they do is produce goods various places in the world and ship them to France, where they are then sold to the French buyer. The question is, where do the profits show up? If the tax rate in the United States is X, nominally 35% these days, whereas in other countries, for example, Ireland, where last I looked, it's around 11 or 12%, then you might want to do the following. Ship the goods you make in Cincinnati first to Ireland. And there you have your subsidiary in Ireland pay your American company a price for those goods equal to what it costs to make them.
No problem.
So on the books of the Cincinnati branch of your company, you've made no profit at all, right? Because it cost you $100 to produce whatever this is, and you sold it to your own subsidiary in Ireland for $100. Right. Then the Ireland subsidiary resends it to France, where you're actually going to sell it. And the invoice there goes, Ireland sells the $100 good that it paid $100 for to the home office in Cincinnati. It sells it to a French buyer for $200. Right. Wow, there's a big fat profit. They paid $100, they sold it for $200. They show a profit, but they show it in Ireland, right, where it's only subject to the tax levied in that society. This is a way of escaping taxes. Countries like Ireland, by the way, do this precisely to have companies do business there of various kinds employing Irish workers, say, rather than Cincinnati workers, etc. So this game has led to a lot of money being kept abroad, where it can get away with paying much lower taxes than if it were earned on paper here. Right. So the question is, isn't this kind of crooked? And the answer is, yeah, sure it is. It's pure tax evasion. Right. And so it has become popular for various people to say, gee, we ought to do something about that. But because all the candidates are subservient to their financial backers, who are the same corporations doing this stuff, the way they propose to do it is charming. Not to punish them for tax evasion, not to change the law so that they can't evade it, such as saying, for example, that no matter where they earn their profits, American corporations will pay profits here, and if they dare to suggest they're leaving the United States, the law could also be amended to say any company which is shown to have proposed a move or made a move to evade taxes will have its assets seized because that is an illegitimate act. None of that kind of proposal, none of that kind of law is ever even spoken about. Instead, what folks like Trump and indeed many others, Republican and Democrat alike, do is to say, and this is where you have to really suspend belief, we need to provide an incentive for the companies to come back. And what you do is you suggest lowering the tax rates here, right, so there'll be less of an inducement for them to evade it because the taxes here are so low or so much lower that there's no longer a need to go abroad. In other words, you allow the game of evasion abroad to be the rationale for cutting the taxes on these corporations at home so they don't leave anymore. It is nothing short of disgusting. Last point. If you lower the taxes on these corporations here at home, and if they bring the money back that they now leave abroad, that still leaves open the question, what will they do with that money when they bring it abroad? The wild assumption that bringing that money home will lead to investing it into job-creating production is the stupidest thing I've heard in a couple of months. Why? Because we have a problem in the world, and the problem is simply put this way. Over the last 40 years, capitalism has moved out of the United States to the rest of the world, moving production particularly to China, to India, to Brazil, and places like that. The reason that was done was to lower wages. And one of the results was to end the long history of rising wages in the United States. That's why over the last 30 years, the American working class, with its wages going nowhere, has been borrowing money for its mortgaged home, for its cars, for its credit cards, and most recently and most horribly, to send their kids to college. And we now have run out of any more debt we can handle. And therefore, the companies are not going to invest in producing a lot more goods here in the United States because the American people can't buy more goods because of that history. In fact, the whole working class of the world now has less money to spend buying goods precisely because capitalism has moved from high-wage to low-wage countries. And I'm not even bringing up the technology and the automation and the computer, which further erodes the possibility of wage increases by making so many people redundant in the workplace. So even if you succeeded in inducing them in this awful way, the notion that this would revive the flagging fortunes of Western Europe, North America, and Japan is pure illusion parlayed for votes by people who probably know better, and if they don't, it's even one more reason not to elect them.
I mean, what you're talking about essentially is setting in motion a race to the bottom with respect to tax policy.
Yes, exactly. Because Ireland, you've been doing that, yeah. Exactly. We just continue. It's just new gimmicks invented by the advisors to Mr. Trump, who've been reading the same journals I do, coming up with yet one more way that we can race to the bottom, this time giving the leading role to a cut in taxes for corporations, who will hopefully, I'm sure the Trump people are hoping, therefore give more generously to his campaign than they might have otherwise done.
And, I mean, a race to the bottom essentially leaves you confronted with exactly the same problem once you hit bottom. So they're kicking the can down the road, essentially, if there were any benefits that came from this. Of course, Ireland lowers its tax rate, then we lower ours, et cetera. Soon you're at the same position that we're at with interest rates, where there's no more distance between you and the bottom. So,
right. I mean, look at that. I don't know if you want to discuss that.
Sure.
But here we now have, I think the latest count is something on the order of $10 or more trillion lent in capital markets, particularly in Western Europe, Japan, and North America now, at negative interest rate. That shows you that the big corporations are now confronted with a situation where they are putting their money into loans that have a negative interest rate. That is, they're going to get back less money than they give to the borrower. And they're doing that in part because they're so worried about the economic future that having a portion of your assets safely tucked away where you know you will get back most of what you've given, that's a sign of trouble, to say the least. And that governments are doing it is, again, the same kind of sign of an economy in extremis. That doesn't say whether it will or will not work. That's another matter, and it's subject to many other influences. But if you're looking for signs to be skeptical of the notion that if you bring money back into the United States, it will be invested in production, you're just not paying attention.
And with the conditions that we're facing, I mean, you have limited number of ways that the state can intervene in the economy to stimulate it. And one area that hasn't really been discussed very much is, of course, government hiring people, essentially. You print money and you create jobs. And in order to be sustainable, the jobs have to actually be sustainable and even somehow related to production in the country. What kind of a prescription would you offer if you had the ear of one of these people?
Well, my sense is that their ears are so plugged up with gold filigree cotton that nothing I say would have any chance of penetrating, but I appreciate the politeness of your way of putting it. So let me respond. First, the last time we had an economic breakdown on the scale of the one we have now, and it was worse, at least so far, it was worse in the 1930s, we did have a response that included government hiring people. The United States government from 1934 to 41 hired, and then the numbers vary, but I would say safely 12 to 15 million people, possibly more, and that's a lot of people now, and it was an even bigger percentage of people then. So we have the tradition in our country of using federal government employment as a way of getting people back into a job, therefore getting them back into earning income, therefore enabling them to pay off their mortgages and to sustain the purchasing power that puts lots of other people to work. That's why it made sense then, and that's why the CIO, the Socialist and Communist Parties, who had a coalition of real strength then, pushed for that and got the then President Roosevelt to do it. One of the most profound signs of the corruption of the current electoral scene, Trump and Clinton both, is that neither of them ever make the slightest reference to what was done last time. They don't even bother to raise questions about it. Their job, both of them, and they perform it beautifully, is to keep it off the agenda, to keep it off the airwaves, off the TV, off the consciousness of the people, since it is a wonderful idea and makes a great deal of sense. We have now roughly 15 to 20 million Americans who are either unemployed, looking for work, or have quit the labor force over the last 6 years because they can't find a decent job. Those people continue to consume goods and services. They eat, they clothe themselves, they try to have a decent life, but they don't produce any of the stuff that they're consuming because they're not given a job. If you did give them a job, for example, if the federal government did, well, then they would consume as they did in any case, but now the new phenomena is they would be producing the things or the equivalent of the things that they're consuming. A clear net gain for our society, no matter how you look at it. Okay, why then isn't it done? There are basically two reasons. One, in order for the government to hire the 15 to 20 million people I'm talking about, you would have to have the money, since the government would have to pay them. And the question is, where would the money come from? And the answer in the 1930s is a big fat clue as to where it would come from now. Namely, you tax corporations and the rich for a big chunk of it. And that is so completely out of the frame of Mrs. Clinton, every bit as much as Mr. Trump, that we can't even discuss the whole idea. It's that scary. Number two. If the federal government somehow got the money and hired these people, thereby transforming their lives, and we're talking here about tens of millions of people when you include the families and the neighborhoods in which they live, doing that wonderful thing for all these people and for the economy as a whole would mean that the government would have to pay a decent salary. And that would create problems for all the private employers that now pay an indecent salary. Let's remember, the federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. Anyone trying to live on that is therefore deep into the very definition of poverty this country maintains. So consequently, the pressure would be on for the government to pay better than that. And that means that all kinds of private employers are going to be competing for laborers with a government that behaves properly, and that's the last thing they want. There won't be a pool of desperate poor people unable to get any other job than working for $8 an hour for Kentucky Fried Chicken or in some dead-end retail selling job. And there are millions and millions of those people making profits for a few corporations at their own expense. And all of that would be at least badly disturbed by a government employment program. So both candidates and both parties act as if that idea, which is part of American history, which was applied successfully the last time we had a crisis of this magnitude, simply doesn't exist. Both candidates are doing their job, keeping the system that enriched them going, and keeping every alternative imaginable off the agenda.
Dr. Wolf, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.